from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI recently published an essay that referenced the Revolution of 1968 as one of the roots of the sexual abuse crisis in the church today. In that essay, he pointed to the over-sexualization of culture that has happened over the last 50 years. That topic has long been the focus of our guest today, scholar and author and Register columnist Jennifer Brobach Morris, whose most recent book is The Sexual State: How Elite Ideologies Are Destroying Lives and Why the Church Was Right All Along. I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register and host of Register Radio, and I'm joined in studio in Birmingham today by Dr. Jennifer Brobach Morris. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm really excited. I'm getting my money's worth out of my trip here.
Absolutely. What, we decided it was four recordings?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, we like to put you to work. Yes. when we see you. But you've been on the show before. We've talked about your work before on the show, but it was always on the phone or on Skype. It's always very good to have a conversation face-to-face. And today is going to probably be a conversation all over the gambit.
Yes.
But of course, there's the interesting topic of the sexual revolution, which we'll get to in a minute, referring to Pope Benedict's recent comments. But you founded the Ruth Institute to address the sexual revolution and the fallout, the breakdown of the family that happened because of the sexual revolution. And the Ruth Institute had an important summit last weekend. So what happened at the summit?
Oh, well, we have been working. I founded the Ruth Institute 10 years ago, mm-hmm. and I was really at that time concerned about women waiting too long to start their families. Mm-hmm. And that's what I thought I was going to be yeah. talking about. And then all sorts of things broke loose, you know, including Proposition 8 there in San Diego. And so I got involved in topics relating to gay marriage, and that one thing led to another. And so around about 2013, we started really thinking about the whole of the sexual revolution, not just gay marriage, not just this little corner or that little corner, just started thinking, how is this all connected?
Right.
And one of the themes that comes out is that every aspect of the sexual revolution, because it's contrary to God's law, because it's contrary to nature, it hurts people. You know, there are people, they're walking wounded everywhere. So we came up with the concept of the survivors of the sexual revolution. And we came up with a list of about 12 different groups of people that have been harmed in some way by the sexual revolution. So including, for example, the most obvious would be the children of divorce.
Right.
Because divorce is harmful to children. I don't care what anyone says. Divorce is harmful to children. And so what we did at the summit this past week, and this is the first of what we hope will be an annual event, the Summit for Survivors of the Sexual Revolution, is we brought together people who have expertise in the particular areas, and then also we brought together survivors themselves. And so we had what we call testimony panels, where people would just say, well, this is what it was like for me when my parents broke up and I was 5 years old. This is what it was really like when my husband told me that he was gay and decided to leave, and so on and so forth. You know, just to give voice to these people who are not normally listened to at all whatsoever. So the two groups we focused on, we had a full day on Saturday. We gave awards on Friday night, and then on Saturday, and this is in Lake Charles, Louisiana, just for everybody to know about our great diocese and our great city there. The two groups we focused on survivors of divorce, mm-hmm. and survivors of the LGBT subculture. And we said, you know, that's enough to do for one
right.
day, you know,
yeah.
and so we put some serious attention on that, like I said, with subject matter experts, you know, the usual talking head kind of thing that you have. You know, we have good talking heads. Don't take anything away from those guys. But and then also the testimonies. And I think the testimonies were the most powerful part of the program, because people, you know, the guys who came for the, you know, for the divorce part did not really know what the whole LGBT thing was about, and the people, and vice versa, you know, and
sure.
they're going, oh my golly, I had no idea that this is so painful for people.
So you brought people together, obviously, to make them aware. Many of these people are already involved in your mission, right?
Yes.
The people who gathered. How do you get, what kind of responses do you get from people who are listening to you describe the effects of the sexual revolution? What makes them go, aha?
Yeah. Well, you know, it took me a while to figure out how to do this because, you know, as you know, my background is in economics. Mm-hmm. And I came at this from the perspective, first of all, of a mother who saw, oh, gosh, kids need their parents. Whoa. You know, that puts the brakes. That changes everything.
Well, we should backtrack. Yeah. Our audience doesn't know this.
Oh,
we had
okay.
a nice, lovely coffee earlier today.
Yes.
And we talked about our state in life, really. And,
yes.
And part of your history was that that you were an economics professor for many years at George Mason.
That's right.
And then there came a point in time where kids came into the picture and you needed to take a step back.
Yes.
And so that's what we talked about.
Yes.
Being the aha.
That was
moment.
The aha for me.
Yeah.
Okay, that was the aha for me. I was a lapsed Catholic. I have a pre-Vatican II upbringing, which is why I have natural law kind of in my DNA, you
sure.
know, because I memorized the whole Baltimore Catechism, which is what people did in those days. And then I was a lapsed Catholic. I was a full participant in the sexual revolution. Let's leave it at that. On my second marriage and so on. And my plan was I was going to get tenure to major university and then and only then start a family.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the babies didn't show up during the month that I had set aside for
wow.
it, oddly enough, you know. And that experience of infertility was what brought me back to the church and the practice of the faith, because I could see then that I wasn't so powerful and so important and in control of
right.
everything like I thought I was. And so we resolved our infertility by adopting a little boy from a Romanian orphanage. And this is in 1991, so this is the beginning of people getting kids from Eastern Europe.
Sure.
He was 2.5 years old when we got him. And then 6 months later, I gave birth to a baby girl. So we have two kids 6 months apart, 3 years apart in chronological age. And having those two children in our home showed us, my husband and me, just how much children need their parents. Because
yeah.
our little boy had been profoundly neglected. There was nothing wrong with him. He had no health problems, you
mm-hmm.
know. But he had been so neglected that he had developed all these, you know, kind of goofy things to do. And there were all kind of things he couldn't do. At the age of 2.5, he didn't know his name.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so think about that
right.
for a moment. Just let that sink in, you know. So, you know, we were scrambling and, you know, trying to educate ourselves and you know, trying to help him. And he's doing fine now. He's doing great, actually. And the two of them are doing great, actually. But it showed us that the whole idea that adults can do whatever they want, and as long as the adults agree to it,
right.
It'll all be fine. Because after all, kids are so resilient, they'll be fine. I'm like, that cannot possibly be
sure.
true. That just can't be true. And then, you know, kind of one thing leads to another, and you start to unpack all of this bundle of stuff we've all been fed, and you realize it's at the core, it's incorrect. And maybe worse than incorrect, it's demonic, really, you know.
Sure.
And so
right.
so I've been on the case for quite a while now, one way or the other. And I forget why you asked me about this. How did we get here?
The aha moment. What do you find in your work ends up being the aha
that's
moment
right.
for
that's
people
right.
today?
That's right. Because, you know, I figured out, okay, kids need their parents. Then I start reading sociological literature, which as a person trained in economics, I can read all those tables of numbers and stuff and I'm not freaked out. I'm not freaked out or you can't bamboozle me with a fancy headline or whatever, you know. And so I start reading all this stuff and I go, oh my gosh, they know. The sociologists, they know kids need their parents. It's all right here in the data. It's been there all along, you know. And so I, you know, I started giving talks on campuses going, look, kids need their parents, you know. And people were upset with me.
Sure.
The students were upset with me because I was raised by a single mom and I'm fine. My mom is fine. You know, it was like, how dare you kind of thing. And so I'm like, okay, I'm doing this wrong. I got to figure this out. I'm going about this wrong. And so, over time, you know, with a lot of encounters like that, you know, where I'm in a room with 50 people or something,
right.
you know, not a mob scene, not a secret, you know, thing where I can't see the audience like you do in broadcast or something, but where I'm really looking at them, I realized that these people, these children of divorce, these children of single parents, they have suffered.
Yes.
And their parents have suffered. Their mom suffered, you know. So how can I make that real to them? How can I convey that? So I started talking in terms of children needing their parents, of people being deceived. I think this was the thing that helped the most, was to say, you know, we all had the idea that this is going to be fine. And a lot of people made decisions based on the idea that their kids would be resilient and it would be fine. And then they found out, to their surprise, that it was a lot harder than they thought.
Absolutely.
Now they're listening, because now I'm not putting their mom down. I'm not putting them down. I'm saying what is absolutely the truth, that we were all kind of conned, you know, into
absolutely
making decisions we wouldn't have made if we had really known. So I think that helps the message a lot.
So you essentially give space to people to recognize the ways they've been hurt by the culture.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And then they go, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know. And so then we've been trying to figure out ways to get people involved, mm-hmm. ways to enlist those people. And we've had various successes and failures with that. But I think one of the big breakthroughs has been to get testimonials from people.
Okay.
And we've done a little bit of that, but Layla Miller really cracked it. You know, she wrote this book called Primal Loss, The Now Adult Children of Divorce Speak.
That's right. The Register reviewed it.
Mm-hmm. And she had she's got a Facebook following and so on, and she just kind of put out these questions. And, you know, like 100 people instantly responded to her. And so she's done a very good job of bringing people together and helping people see the commonalities. And so I wrote the foreword to that book.
Okay.
She asked me to, and I was of course, delighted, you know, to do that. And we sell it in the Ruth Institute bookstore and everything, you know, because I think it's a really important contribution.
Absolutely. So you must have been grateful, I guess, recently for Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI's words, which this isn't new for Cardinal Ratzinger talked all the time about the effects of over-sexualized culture. But this is obviously what you have
right.
built your professional life around.
Right.
He identified in the crisis that we're experiencing in the church right now, the sexual abuse crisis, priests who have abused members of the faithful or other clergy, other priests. How do you understand this moment that we're living in? How does your work correspond to this moment?
Well, I'll tell you, when we developed that list of survivors of the sexual mm-hmm. revolution, which, by the way, we have a pamphlet of that has all that in there, and if people want to, they can go to the Ruth Institute store and buy the pamphlet or just look at it online. If you look at it, you won't see survivors of sexual abuse on the list. And that was deliberate, because when we developed that in 2013, I said to myself, well, it's not really fair to blame sexual abuse on the sexual revolution, because it's been around forever, mm-hmm. you know, and that's always been a problem. It's always been out there. So I don't want to deal with that. And truthfully, I didn't really want to deal with it, because, you know, it's nasty. Nobody
right.
really wants to deal with it. It's icky. It's awful, you know, and it makes people uncomfortable. And, you know, you just no one really wants to deal with it. So I was glad to have an excuse. That was my excuse to not deal with it.
Yeah.
But as things have unfolded, when things unfolded with the Me Too, if you remember, Harvey Weinstein and all that stuff happened before McCarrick, then
absolutely.
McCarrick, then all this other stuff. And I started thinking to myself, you know, the sexual revolution really is implicated here in two ways. The sexual revolution, of course, I define it as being a set of ideas. It's an ideology, you know. And those ideas disarm the victim. The sexual revolution tells everybody that you're supposed to, that sex is all good all the time and it's all fun, and the restraints we're all just nonsense and we don't have to take any of that seriously. So the potential victim is disarmed by that. You
sure.
have to make an excuse for yourself. You have to explain why you don't want to get on the casting couch with Harvey Weinstein. You know, and same with those seminarians and the whole thing, you know. So it disarms the victim, but it also empowers and emboldens the predator. Because the key idea of the sexual revolution is everybody's entitled to sex.
Right.
Everybody's entitled to guilt-free, child-free, problem-free sex. Well, you know, of course that's an illusion, number one, but who really thinks that? A rapist thinks that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sense of entitlement. So it really is deeply implicated. And so, you know, when I started thinking, oh, well, I guess I'm going to have to talk about this after all, you know, get involved in this whole thing, you know. So I was grateful that Pope Benedict mentioned that, really, because I think it doesn't help church governance. I mean, it doesn't help decide, you know, what are the procedures going to be and do we need to change canon law and all that. It doesn't deal with that aspect of it. But I think it is very important to recognize it as a huge factor in Absolutely. What enables the whole thing.
Absolutely. And, you know, you have been talking about this. You did get involved in the this connection between the over-sexualization of culture and the church problem of sexual abuse, which is not, of course, just a church problem.
Right.
But
right.
you've been writing for the Register on this very topic, really.
Yes.
And you've said a lot about how laity can get involved. I mean, we, again, talked earlier during our nice coffee about how the bishops, you know, so many people are calling for policy changes,
mm-hmm.
policy changes. Well, we can ask for policy changes and we can really encourage and petition our bishops to do so. But there's also more that the laity can do. And you've written a lot about that. What do you suggest that the laity do?
Well, first of all, I mean, we need to stop looking at the bishops as if they're in command and control of everything, because they're not, first of all. And, you know, God is not going to send us a man on a white horse to rescue us. He sent us, you know, and we have to do our part. And what I believe is true is that the way we as laity interact with our clergy, the way we interact with our young people who are victims or potentially victims and so on, the way we interact has a lot to do with the constraints that they operate under. So just take for an example, recently we have this incident in Buffalo
mm-hmm.
where several priests were at a priests and seminarians were at a party, and the conversation became very vulgar and sounds like completely inappropriate. Now, me here in Birmingham in Louisiana, I don't know what actually happened over there, but and there's no way for me to know what happened over there. But the thing that's very powerful about that moment is that the seminarian spoke up.
Right.
Now, why did he speak up this time? And 2 years ago, he wouldn't have spoken up. He spoke up because he knew that there would be people listening, there'd be people backing him up, that if he was shut down, that somebody would say something about it. He could, you know, and why? Why do people know that? Because we as laity are watching.
Right.
And we are going to do something. We are going to say something. And so I think people need to just be aware that it's not nothing that you're watching, people.
Right. Right. And there's, I think you're absolutely right. And you mentioned the Me Too movement. The Me Too movement having happened right before last summer when the McCarrick
yes.
revelations happened, I think helped to amplify the problem.
Yes.
You know, it helped us to be more aware of the problem, not only of a problem of sexual abuse of minors, but a problem of harassment
yes.
and unwanted advancement between adults.
Yes.
And in a way, it's a very strange grace that is happening in the church right now.
I feel like the Mother of God has kind of pulled back the covers and shone a flashlight on things, and you know the little cockroaches are scurrying
oh,
because
God.
There's lights on them, that, you know, and she's doing that throughout the Western society, you know, just the revelations are wholesome, and we need to, you know, continue to speak the truth and not be freaked out about it. The thing about the Me Too movement that is interesting, that it happened before all the church revelations, you could kind of see that yes, this is important and it's good that we're talking about it, but the mainstream media and even the mainstream feminists didn't really know what to do with it, because they're hanging on to the sexual revolution. They
right.
they want to still have sex whenever they want to, but they don't want to be coerced, and gosh, he went too far, and you know, we need to define consent more carefully, and you know, and I think madness lies down that path, quite
yeah.
honestly. I don't think it can be solved. Consent, I think the whole Me Too moment shows that consent is just too thin of a reed to base your sexual ethics on. That's just not enough. And, you know, we knew that all along. Catholic Church knew that all along,
right?
We always knew there was a little more constraint besides consent. But now I think it's becoming more apparent to a wider group of people, that can't be good enough.
Right. Now, you just said the Catholic Church knew this all along. We've got about 5 minutes left. But I do want to talk a little bit more about your book, because you mentioned that the sexual revolution is basically ideologies.
Yes.
Certain ideologies that have controlled our culture, have controlled our state.
Yes.
They are the ideologies of contraception, of divorce, and of gender.
Mm-hmm.
How are we trying to unravel ourselves from these ideologies? And the church is right.
Yes. I maintain that the church's teaching, as found in the catechism, the church's teachings are correct and have been all along. And there have been people inside the church who have known all along and who have done their darndest to keep proclaiming those truths. But what I define as the sexual revolution is three interlocking ideologies. One, the idea that a good society should do everything possible to separate sex from babies. And that's my definition of the contraceptive ideology. Two, that a good society should do everything possible to separate both sex and babies from marriage. And that's what I call the divorce ideology. And three, that a good society should recognize that men and women are really, really the same, that there are no significant differences between men and women that are really worth bothering with. It's all socially constructed. It can be socially reconstructed, and it can be now personally reconstructed.
Absolutely.
Through transgenderism. That's the gender ideology. So those three things are really a revolt against the body. They're a revolt against nature. And the Catholic Church is like the last man standing, saying, you know, nature gets a vote, right? Nature is what it is. You know, reality is something. And we're banging our heads up against reality and we're getting bruised foreheads because it's not working. They can't be made to work. And that's the key, I think, the most helpful takeaway for the average person reading The Sexual State, is that these three ideologies that I just mentioned, they're all false.
Of course,
they're
right.
All completely incorrect. And so if we have rich and powerful people absolutely committed to a fantasy ideology that cannot be made to be real. It can't be brought. You can't make a world where sex doesn't make babies. You know, you really can't do that. And so they need a lot of power.
Mm-hmm.
They need a lot of force, and they need a lot of propaganda, a lot of propaganda. So I spend a bunch of the time in the book going through specific kinds of propaganda that you can see, because all these people, these survivors, all these people who've been wounded, they all have to be silenced. You can't be letting children raise their hand and say, it really stunk when my parents
right.
got divorced. That would upend the whole thing. So you have to silence all those people. All the post-abortive women, they have to be silenced. All the people who'd like to leave the LGBT lifestyle, you can't give them a turn at the microphone, for crying out loud. That disrupts the whole narrative, you know? So there are millions of people who have suffered and whose lives do not conform to the official line, and they all have to be silenced. That takes a lot of state power and a lot of social and cultural power, and that's what's happening to us.
Right. But that's also what is being is exploding right now. I
yes.
think people can't remain silent anymore.
Yes.
And the more they speak out, the more they speak out. I also think that's an opportunity.
Yes, ma'am. Absolutely.
And that's where those of us who are formed in the truth have the opportunity to speak the truth.
Yes.
And to continue to speak it. Not only in these sort of dogmatic ways, you know, as you mentioned,
right.
it's not all about policy.
Right.
This is about personal lives.
Right.
It's about hurt and healing, and that healing is possible.
Do you know, at our summit, I told people, you know, look, we all need to do something. So what I want you to do is take the pamphlet that has all the 12 survivors,
mm-hmm.
and I want you to start writing down names of people you know who have been harmed by the sexual revolution.
Oh, interesting. Wow.
And pledge that you're going to reach out to them in some way. You know, that you're going to take them for coffee. Maybe you need to make amends to them, but you're going to listen to them, and you're going to reach out to them and be there for them. I would really encourage people to join us on the Ruth Institute Facebook
Please.
Page,
mm-hmm.
because this area is moving so fast. There's
right.
always something new and crazy going on, and so it's important to stay. We try to stay abreast. We try to keep up with it, and we have a weekly newsletter also that you can sign up for that will keep you very well informed about these matters. Ruth Institute Facebook page, ruthinstitute.org.
And that's right. And I'll spell that out just for people, just in case. It's Ruth Institute, RuthInstitute. .org. So ruthinstitute.org, you can sign up for the newsletter. You can check out Dr. Morse's books.
Yes.
You can also go to ncregister.com, where you can see her biweekly, every other week, column, and of course subscribe to the Register, where we print those columns. You've really had some great columns lately. One that I really appreciate is the weaponizing of self-pity.
Oh my gosh.
Part one and two.
So read these.
They're extremely important for understanding the battles that we face today. Dr. Morse, thank you for being with us.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you for having me, Jeanette.
Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us here on Register Radio on EWTN.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
This Easter season, read for faith, read for truth, read for life by giving yourself the gift of EWTN's National Catholic Register. Easter inaugurates a joyous season of hope and renewal that brings us closer to God. Gain a deeper understanding of His love and providence in reading the Register. Make this Easter season even more meaningful. Try the Register for free today and get it delivered to your home, office, or parish. To get your 6 free issues, order online at ncregister.com/radio or call 800-421-3230 and mention code radio. That's ncregister.com/radio or call 800-421-3230 and mention code radio. The National Catholic Register. Read faithfully.